generates a limited set of basic assessments, represents sets by norms and prototypes, does not integrate, matches intensities across scales, for example, size to loudness, computes more than intended, mental shotgun, sometimes substitutes an easier question for a difficult one, heuristics, is more sensitive to changes than to states, prospect theory, overweights low probabilities, shows diminishing sensitivity to quantity, psychophysics, responds more strongly to losses than to gains, loss aversion, frames decision problems narrowly, in isolation from one another. Part 2. Heuristics and Biases. Chapter 10. The Law of Small Numbers. A study of the incidence of kidney cancer in the 3,141 counties of the United States reveals a remarkable pattern. The counties in which the incidence of kidney cancer is lowest are mostly rural, sparsely populated, and located in traditionally Republican states in the Midwest, the South, and the West. What do you make of this? Your mind has been very active in the last few seconds, and it was mainly a System 2 operation. You deliberately searched memory and formulated hypotheses. Some effort was involved. Your pupils dilated, and your heart rate increased measurably. But System 1 was not idle. The operation of System 2 depended on the facts and suggestions retrieved from associative memory. You probably rejected the idea that Republican politics provide protection against kidney cancer. Very likely, you ended up focusing on the fact that the counties with low incidence of cancer are mostly rural. The witty statisticians Howard Wehner and Harris Zwirling, from whom I learned this example, commented, "It is both easy and tempting to infer that their low cancer rates are directly due to the clean living of the rural lifestyle. No air pollution, no water pollution, access to fresh food without additives." This makes perfect sense. Now, consider the counties in which the incidence of kidney cancer is highest. These ailing counties tend to be mostly rural, sparsely populated, and located in traditionally Republican states in the Midwest, the South, and the West. Tongue in cheek, Wehner and Zwirling comment, "It is easy to infer that their high cancer rates might be directly due to the poverty of the rural lifestyle. No access to good medical care, a high-fat diet, and too much alcohol, too much tobacco." Something is wrong, of course. The rural lifestyle cannot explain both very high and very low incidence of kidney cancer. The key factor is not that the counties were rural or predominantly Republican. It is that rural counties have small populations. And the main lesson to be learned is not about epidemiology. It is about the difficult relationship between our mind and statistics. System 1 is highly adept in one form of thinking. It automatically and effortlessly identifies causal connections between events, sometimes even when the connection is spurious. When told about the high incidence counties, you immediately assumed that these counties are different from other counties for a reason, that there must be a cause that explains this difference. As we shall see, however, System 1 is inept when faced with merely statistical facts, which change the probability of outcomes but do not cause them to happen. A random event, by definition, does not lend itself to explanation, but collections of random events do behave in a highly regular fashion. Imagine a large urn filled with marbles. Half the marbles are red, half are white. Next, Imagine a very patient person, or a robot, who blindly draws 4 marbles from the urn, records the number of red balls in the sample, throws the balls back into the urn, and then does it all again, many times. If you summarize the results, you will find that the outcome, 2 red, 2 white, occurs almost exactly 6 times as often as the outcome, 4 red or 4 white. This relationship is a mathematical fact. You can predict the outcome of repeated sampling from an urn just as confidently as you can predict what will happen if you hit an egg with a hammer. You cannot predict every detail of how the shell will shatter, but you can be sure of the general idea. There is a difference. The satisfying sense of causation that you experience when thinking of a hammer hitting an egg is altogether absent when you think about sampling. A related statistical fact is relevant to the cancer example. From the same urn, 2 very patient marble counters take turns. Jack draws 4 marbles on each trial. Jill draws 7. They both record each time they observe a homogeneous sample, all white or all red. If they go on long enough, Jack will observe such extreme outcomes more often than Jill, by a factor of 8. The expected percentages are 12.5% and 1.56%. Again, no hammer, no causation, but a mathematical fact. Samples of 4 marbles yield extreme results more often than samples of 7 marbles do. Now, imagine the population of the United States as marbles in a giant urn. Some marbles are marked KC for kidney cancer. You draw samples of marbles and populate each county in turn. Rural counties are smaller than other counties. Just as in the game of Jack and Jill, extreme outcomes, very high and or very low cancer rates, are most likely to be found in sparsely populated counties. This is all there is to the story. We started from a fact that calls for a cause. The incidence of kidney cancer varies widely across counties, and the differences are systematic. The explanation I offered is statistical. Extreme outcomes, both high and low, are more likely to be found in small than in large counties. This explanation is not causal. The small population of a county neither causes nor prevents cancer. It merely allows the incidence of cancer to be much higher or much lower than it is in the larger population. The deeper truth is that there is nothing to explain. The incidence of cancer is not truly lower or higher than normal in a county with a small population. It just appears to be so in a particular year because of an accident of sampling. If we repeat the analysis next year, we will observe the same general pattern of extreme results in the small counties, but the counties where cancer was common last year will not necessarily have a high incidence this year. If this is the case, the differences between large and small counties do not really count as facts. They are what scientists call artifacts, observations that are produced entirely by some aspect of the method of research. In this case, by differences in sample size. The story I have told may have surprised you, but it was not a revelation. You have long known that the results of large samples deserve more trust than smaller samples, and even people who are innocent of statistical knowledge have heard about this law of large numbers. But knowing is not a yes-no affair, and you may find that the following statements apply to you. The feature sparsely populated did not immediately stand out as relevant when you read the epidemiological story. You were at least mildly surprised by the size of the difference between samples of 4 and samples of 7. Even now, you must exert some mental effort to see that the following 2 statements mean exactly the same thing. Large samples are more precise than small samples. Small samples yield extreme results more often than large samples do. The first statement has a clear ring of truth. But until the second version makes intuitive sense, you have not truly understood the first. The bottom line. Yes, you did know that the results of large samples are more precise, but you may now realize that you did not know it very well. You are not alone. The first study that Amos and I did together showed that even sophisticated researchers have poor intuitions and a wobbly understanding of sampling effects. The Law of Small Numbers. My collaboration with Amos in the early 1970s began with a discussion of the claim that people who have had no training in statistics are good intuitive statisticians. He told my seminar and me of researchers at the University of Michigan who were generally optimistic about intuitive statistics. I had strong feelings about that claim, which I took personally. I had recently discovered that I was not a good intuitive statistician, and I did not believe that I was worse than others. For a research psychologist, sampling variation is not a curiosity. It is a nuisance and a costly obstacle, which turns the undertaking of every research project into a gamble. Suppose that you wish to confirm the hypothesis that the vocabulary of the average 6-year-old girl is larger than the vocabulary of an average boy of the same age. The hypothesis is true in the population. The average vocabulary of girls is indeed larger. Girls and boys vary a great deal, however, and by the luck of the draw, you could select a sample in which the difference is inconclusive, or even one in which boys actually score higher. If you are the researcher, this outcome is costly to you because you have wasted time and effort and failed to confirm a hypothesis that was in fact true. Using a sufficiently large sample is the only way to reduce the risk. Researchers who pick too small a sample leave themselves at the mercy of sampling luck. The risk of error can be estimated for any given sample size by a fairly simple procedure. Traditionally, however, psychologists do not use calculations to decide on a sample size. They use their judgment, which is commonly flawed. An article I had read shortly before the debate with Amos demonstrated the mistake that researchers made, they still do, by a dramatic observation. The author pointed out that psychologists commonly chose samples so small that they exposed themselves to a 50% risk of failing to confirm their true hypotheses. No researcher in his right mind would accept such a risk. A plausible explanation was that psychologists' decisions about sample size reflected prevalent intuitive misconceptions of the extent of sampling variation. The article shocked me because it explained some troubles I had had in my own research. Like most research psychologists, I had routinely chosen samples that were too small and had often obtained results that made no sense. Now I knew why. The odd results were actually artifacts of my research method. My mistake was particularly embarrassing because I taught statistics and knew how to compute the sample size that would reduce the risk of failure to an acceptable level. But I had never chosen a sample size by computation. Like my colleagues, I had trusted tradition and my intuition in planning my experiments and had never thought seriously about the issue. When Amos visited the seminar, I had already reached the conclusion that my intuitions were deficient, and in the course of the seminar, we quickly agreed that the Michigan optimists were wrong. Amos and I set out to examine whether I was the only fool or a member of a majority of fools by testing whether researchers selected for mathematical expertise would make similar mistakes. We developed a questionnaire that described realistic research situations, including replications of successful experiments. It asked the researchers to choose sample sizes to assess the risks of failure to which their decisions exposed them, and to provide advice to hypothetical graduate students planning their research. Amos collected the responses of a group of sophisticated participants, including authors of two statistical textbooks, at a meeting of the Society of Mathematical Psychology. The results were straightforward. I was not the only fool. Every one of the mistakes I had made was shared by a large majority of our respondents. It was evident that even the experts paid insufficient attention to sample size. Amos and I called our first joint article, Belief in the Law of Small Numbers. We explained, tongue-in-cheek, that intuitions about random sampling appear to satisfy the law of small numbers, which asserts that the law of large numbers applies to small numbers as well. We also included a strongly worded recommendation that researchers regard their statistical intuitions with proper suspicion and replace impression formation by computation whenever possible. A bias of confidence over doubt. In a telephone poll of 300 seniors, 60% support the president. If you had to summarize the message of this sentence in exactly three words, what would they be? Almost certainly you would choose, elderly support president. These words provide the gist of the story. The omitted details of the poll, that it was done on the phone with a sample of 300, are of no interest in themselves. They provide background information that attracts little attention. Your summary would be the same if the sample size had been different. Of course, a completely absurd number would draw your attention. A telephone poll of 6 or 60 million elderly voters. Unless you are a professional, however, you may not react very differently to a sample of 150 and to a sample of 3,000. That is the meaning of the statement that people are not adequately sensitive to sample size. The message about the poll contains information of two kinds, the story and the source of the story. Naturally, you focus on the story rather than on the reliability of the results. When the reliability is obviously low, however, the message will be discredited. If you are told that a partisan group has conducted a flawed and biased poll to show that the elderly support the president, you will, of course, reject the findings of the poll, and they will not become part of what you believe. Instead, the partisan poll and its false results will become a new story about political lies. You can choose to disbelieve a message in such clear-cut cases, but do you discriminate sufficiently between I read in the New York Times and I heard at the water cooler? Can your system one distinguish degrees of belief? The principle of what you see is all there is suggests that it cannot. As I described earlier, System 1 is not prone to doubt. It suppresses ambiguity and spontaneously constructs stories that are as coherent as possible. Unless the message is immediately negated, the associations that it evokes will spread as if the message were true. System 2 is capable of doubt, because it can maintain incompatible possibilities at the same time. However, sustaining doubt is harder work than sliding into certainty. The law of small numbers is a manifestation of a general bias that favors certainty over doubt, which will turn up in many guises in following chapters. The strong bias toward believing that small samples closely resemble the population from which they are drawn is also part of a larger story. We are prone to exaggerate the consistency and coherence of what we see. The exaggerated faith of researchers in what can be learned from a few observations is closely related to the halo effect, the sense we often get that we know and understand a person about whom we actually know very little. System 1 runs ahead of the facts in constructing a rich image on the basis of scraps of evidence. A machine, for jumping to conclusions, will act as if it believed in the law of small numbers. More generally, it will produce a representation of reality that makes too much sense. Cause and chance. The associative machinery seeks causes. The difficulty we have with statistical regularities is that they call for a different approach. Instead of focusing on how the event at hand came to be, the statistical view relates it to what could have happened instead. Nothing in particular caused it to be what it is. Chance selected it from among its alternatives. Our predilection for causal thinking exposes us to serious mistakes in evaluating the randomness of truly random events. For an example, take the sex of 6 babies born in sequence at a hospital. The sequence of boys and girls is obviously random. The events are independent of each other, and the number of boys and girls who were born in the hospital in the last few hours has no effect whatsoever on the sex of the next baby. Now consider 3 possible sequences. B, 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 G, G, G. G, 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 G. B, G, B, B, G, B. Are the sequences equally likely? The intuitive answer, of course not, is false. Because the events are independent, and because the outcomes B and G are approximately equally likely, then any possible sequence of 6 births is as likely as any other. Even now that you know this conclusion is true, it remains counterintuitive, because only the 3rd sequence appears random. As expected, BG, BB, GB is judged much more likely than the other 2 sequences. We are pattern seekers, believers in a coherent world in which regularities, such as a sequence of 6 girls, appear not by accident, but as a result of mechanical causality or of someone's intention. We do not expect to see regularity produced by a random process, and when we detect what appears to be a rule, we quickly reject the idea that the process is truly random. Random processes produce many sequences that convince people that the process is not random after all. You can see why assuming causality could have had evolutionary advantages. It is part of the general vigilance that we have inherited from ancestors. We are automatically on the lookout for the possibility that the environment has changed. Lions may appear on the plain at random times, but it would be safer to notice and respond to an apparent increase in the rate of appearance of prides of lions, even if it is actually due to the fluctuations of a random process. The widespread misunderstanding of randomness sometimes has significant consequences. In our article on representativeness, Amos and I cited the statistician William Feller, who illustrated the ease with which people see patterns where none exists. During the intensive rocket bombing of London in World War II, it was generally believed that the bombing could not be random because a map of the hits revealed conspicuous gaps. Some suspected that German spies were located in the unharmed areas. A careful statistical analysis revealed that the distribution of hits was typical of a random process, and typical as well in evoking a strong impression that it was not random. To the untrained eye, Feller remarks, randomness appears as regularity or tendency to cluster. I soon had an occasion to apply what I had learned from Feller. The Yom Kippur War broke out in 1973, and my only significant contribution to the war effort was to advise high officers in the Israeli Air Force to stop an investigation. The air war initially went quite badly for Israel because of the unexpectedly good performance of Egyptian ground-to-air missiles. Losses were high, and they appeared to be unevenly distributed. I was told of two squadrons flying from the same base, one of which had lost four planes, while the other had lost none. An inquiry was initiated in the hope of learning what it was that the unfortunate squadron was doing wrong. There was no prior reason to believe that one of the squadrons was more effective than the other, and no operational differences were found, but of course, the lives of the pilots differed in many random ways, including, as I recall, how often they went home between missions and something about the conduct of debriefings. My advice was that the command should accept that the different outcomes were due to blind luck, and that the interviewing of the pilots should stop. I reasoned that luck was the most likely answer, that a random search for a non-obvious cause was hopeless, and that in the meantime, the pilots in the squadron that had sustained losses did not need the extra burden of being made to feel that they and their dead friends were at fault. Some years later, Amos and his students Tom Gilovich and Robert Vallone caused a stir with their study of misperceptions of randomness in basketball. The fact that players occasionally acquire a hot hand is generally accepted by players, coaches, and fans. The inference is irresistible. A player sinks three or four baskets in a row, and you cannot help forming the causal judgment that this player is now hot, with a temporarily increased propensity to score. Players on both teams adapt to this judgment. Teammates are more likely to pass to the hot scorer, and the defense is more likely to double-team. Analysis of thousands of sequences of shots led to a disappointing conclusion. There is no such thing as a hot hand in professional basketball, either in shooting from the field or scoring from the foul line. Of course, some players are more accurate than others, but the sequence of successes and missed shots satisfies all tests of randomness. The hot hand is entirely in the eye of the beholders, who are consistently too quick to perceive order and causality in randomness. The hot hand is a massive and widespread cognitive illusion. The public reaction to this research is part of the story. The finding was picked up by the press because of its surprising conclusion, and the general response was disbelief. When the celebrated coach of the Boston Celtics, Red Auerbach, heard of Gilovich and his study, he responded, "Who is this guy? So he makes a study. I couldn't care less." The tendency to see patterns in randomness is overwhelming, certainly more impressive than a guy making a study. The illusion of pattern affects our lives in many ways off the basketball court. How many good years should you wait before concluding that an investment advisor is unusually skilled? How many successful acquisitions should be needed for a board of directors to believe that the CEO has extraordinary flair for such deals? The simple answer to these questions is that if you follow your intuition, you will more often than not err by misclassifying a random event as systematic. We are far too willing to reject the belief that much of what we see in life is random. I began this chapter with the example of cancer incidents across the United States. The example appears in a book intended for statistics teachers, but I learned about it from an amusing article by the two statisticians I quoted earlier, Howard Wehner and Harris Zwirling. Their essay focused on a large investment, some $1.7 billion, which the Gates Foundation made to follow up intriguing findings on the characteristics of the most successful schools. Many researchers have sought the secret of successful education by identifying the most successful schools in the hope of discovering what distinguishes them from others. One of the conclusions of this research is that the most successful schools, on average, are small. In a survey of 1,662 schools in Pennsylvania, for instance, six of the top 50 were small, which is an overrepresentation by a factor of four. These data encouraged the Gates Foundation to make a substantial investment in the creation of small schools, sometimes by splitting large schools into smaller units. At least half a dozen other prominent institutions, such as the Annenberg Foundation and the Pew Charitable Trust, joined the effort, as did the U.S. Department of Education's Smaller Learning Communities program. This probably makes intuitive sense to you. It is easy to construct a causal story that explains how small schools are able to provide superior education and thus produce high-achieving scholars by giving them more personal attention and encouragement than they could get in larger schools. Unfortunately, the causal analysis is pointless because the facts are wrong. If the statisticians who reported to the Gates Foundation had asked about the characteristics of the worst schools, they would have found that bad schools also tend to be smaller than average. The truth is that small schools are not better on average. They are simply more variable. If anything, say Wehner and Zwirling, large schools tend to produce better results, especially in higher grades where a variety of curricular options is valuable. Thanks to recent advances in cognitive psychology, we can now see clearly what Amos and I could only glimpse. The law of small numbers is part of two larger stories about the workings of the mind. The exaggerated faith in small samples is only one example of a more general illusion. We pay more attention to the content of messages than to information about their reliability, and as a result, end up with a view of the world around us that is simpler and more coherent than the data justify. Jumping to conclusions is a safer sport in the world of our imagination than it is in reality. Statistics produce many observations that appear to beg for causal explanations, but do not lend themselves to such explanations. Many facts of the world are due to chance, including accidents of sampling. Causal explanations of chance events are inevitably wrong. Speaking of the law of small numbers. Yes, the studio has had three successful films since the new CEO took over, but it is too early to declare that he has a hot hand. I won't believe that the new trader is a genius before consulting a statistician who could estimate the likelihood of his streak being a chance event. The sample of observations is too small to make any inferences. Let's not follow the law of small numbers. I plan to keep the results of the experiment secret until we have a sufficiently large sample. Otherwise, we will face pressure to reach a conclusion prematurely. Chapter 11. Anchors. Amos and I once rigged a Wheel of Fortune. It was marked from 0 to 100, but we had it built so that it would stop only at 10 or 65. We recruited students of the University of Oregon as participants in our experiment. One of us would stand in front of a small group, spin the wheel, and ask them to write down the number on which the wheel stopped, which of course was either 10 or 65. We then asked them two questions. Is the percentage of African nations among UN members larger or smaller than the number you just wrote? What is your best guess of the percentage of African nations in the UN? The spin of a Wheel of Fortune, even one that is not rigged, cannot possibly yield useful information about anything, and the participants in our experiment should simply have ignored it. But they did not ignore it. The average estimates of those who saw 10 and 65 were 25% and 45% respectively. The phenomenon we were studying is so common and so important in the everyday world that you should know its name. It is an anchoring effect. It occurs when people consider a particular value for an unknown quantity before estimating that quantity. What happens is one of the most reliable and robust results of experimental psychology. The estimates stay close to the number that people considered, hence the image of an anchor. If you are asked whether Gandhi was more than 114 years old when he died, you will end up with a much higher estimate at his age of death than if you would if the anchoring question referred to death at 35. If you consider how much you should pay for a house, you will be influenced by the asking price. The same house will appear more valuable if its listing price is high than if it is low, even if you are determined to resist the influence of this number, and so on. The list of anchoring effects is endless. Any number that you are asked to consider as a possible solution to an estimation problem will induce an anchoring effect. We were not the first to observe the effects of anchors, but our experiment was the first demonstration of its absurdity. People's judgments were influenced by an obviously uninformative number. There was no way to describe the anchoring effect of a Wheel of Fortune as reasonable. Amos and I published the experiment in our science paper, and it is one of the best known of the findings we reported there. There was only one trouble. Amos and I did not fully agree on the psychology of the anchoring effect. He supported one interpretation, I liked another, and we never found a way to settle the argument. The problem was finally solved decades later by the efforts of numerous investigators. It is now clear that Amos and I were both right. Two different mechanisms produce anchoring effects, one for each system. There is a form of anchoring that occurs in a deliberate process of adjustment, an operation of system two. And there is anchoring that occurs by a priming effect, an automatic manifestation of system one. Anchoring as adjustment. Amos liked the idea of an adjust and anchor heuristic as a strategy for estimating uncertain quantities. Start from an anchoring number, assess whether it is too high or too low, and gradually adjust your estimate by mentally moving from the anchor. The adjustment typically ends prematurely because people stop when they are no longer certain that they should move farther. Decades after our disagreement, and years after Amos's death, convincing evidence of such a process was offered independently by two psychologists who had worked closely with Amos early in their careers, Eldar Shafir and Tom Gilovich, together with their own students, Amos's intellectual grandchildren. To get the idea, take a sheet of paper and draw a 2.5-inch line going up, starting at the bottom of the page, without a ruler. Now take another sheet and start at the top and draw a line going down until it is 2.5 inches from the bottom. Compare the lines. There is a good chance that your first estimate of 2.5 inches was shorter than the second. The reason is that you do not know exactly what such a line looks like. There is a range of uncertainty. You stop near the bottom of the region of uncertainty when you start from the bottom of the page, and near the top of the region when you start from the top. Robin LaBeouf and Shafir found many examples of that mechanism in daily experience. Insufficient adjustment neatly explains why you are likely to drive too fast when you come off the highway onto city streets, especially if you are talking with someone as you drive. Insufficient adjustment is also a source of tension between exasperated parents and teenagers who enjoy loud music in their room. LaBeouf and Shafir note that a well-intentioned child who turns down exceptionally loud music to meet a parent's demand that is played at a reasonable volume may fail to adjust sufficiently from a high anchor and may feel that genuine attempts at compromise are being overlooked. The driver and the child both deliberately adjust down and both fail to adjust enough. Now consider these questions. When did George Washington become president? What is the boiling temperature of water at the top of Mount Everest? The first thing that happens when you consider each of these questions is that an anchor comes to mind, and you know both that it is wrong and the direction of the correct answer. You know immediately that George Washington became president after 1776, and you also know that the boiling temperature of water at the top of Mount Everest is lower than 100 degrees Celsius. You have to adjust in the appropriate direction by finding arguments to move away from the anchor. As in the case of the lines, you are likely to stop when you are no longer sure you should go farther, at the near edge of the region of uncertainty. Nick Epley and Tom Gilovich found evidence that adjustment is a deliberate attempt to find reasons to move away from the anchor. People who are instructed to shake their head when they hear the anchor, as if they rejected it, move farther from the anchor, and people who nod their head show enhanced anchoring. Epley and Gilovich also confirmed that adjustment is an effortful operation. People adjust less, stay closer to the anchor, when their mental resources are depleted, either because their memory is loaded with digits or because they are slightly drunk. Insufficient adjustment is a failure of a weak or lazy system too. So we now know that Amos was right for at least some cases of anchoring, which involve a deliberate system too adjustment in a specified direction from an anchor. Anchoring as priming effect. When Amos and I debated anchoring, I agreed that adjustment sometimes occurs, but I was uneasy. Adjustment is a deliberate and conscious activity, but in most cases of anchoring, there is no corresponding subjective experience. Consider these two questions. Was Gandhi more or less than 144 years old when he died? How old was Gandhi when he died? Did you produce your estimate by adjusting down from 144? Probably not. But the absurdly high number still affected your estimate. My hunch was that anchoring is a case of suggestion. This is the word we use when someone causes us to see, hear, or feel something by merely bringing it to mind. For example, the question, "Do you now feel a slight numbness in your left leg?" always prompts quite a few people to report that their left leg does indeed feel a little strange. Amos was more conservative than I was about hunches, and he correctly pointed out that appealing to suggestion did not help us understand anchoring because we did not know how to explain suggestion. I had to agree that he was right, but I never became enthusiastic about the idea of insufficient adjustment as the sole cause of anchoring effects. We conducted many inconclusive experiments in an effort to understand anchoring, but we failed and eventually gave up the idea of writing more about it. The puzzle that defeated us is now solved, because the concept of suggestion is no longer obscure. Suggestion is a priming effect, which selectively evokes compatible evidence. You did not believe for a moment that Gandhi lived for 144 years, but your associative machinery surely generated an impression of a very ancient person. System 1 understands sentences by trying to make them true, and the selective activation of compatible thoughts produces a family of systematic errors that makes us gullible and prone to believe too strongly whatever we believe. We can now see why Amos and I did not realize that there were two types of anchoring. The research techniques and theoretical ideas we needed did not yet exist. They were developed, much later, by other people. A process that resembles suggestion is indeed at work in many situations. System 1 tries its best to construct a world in which the anchor is the true number. This is one of the manifestations of associative coherence that I described in the first part of the book. The German psychologists Thomas Musweiler and Fritz Strack offered the most compelling demonstrations of the role of associative coherence in anchoring. In one experiment, they asked an anchoring question about temperature. Is the annual mean temperature in Germany higher or lower than 20 degrees Celsius, 68 degrees Fahrenheit? Or is the annual mean temperature in Germany higher or lower than 5 degrees Celsius, 40 degrees Fahrenheit? All participants were then briefly shown words that they were asked to identify. The researchers found that 68 degrees Fahrenheit made it easier to recognize summer words like sun and beach, and 40 degrees Fahrenheit facilitated winter words like frost and ski. The selective activation of compatible memories explains anchoring. The high and the low numbers activate different sets of ideas in memory. The estimates of annual temperature draw on these biased samples of ideas and are therefore biased as well. In another elegant study in the same vein, participants were asked about the average price of German cars. A high anchor selectively primed the names of luxury brands, Mercedes, Audi, whereas the low anchor primed brands associated with mass-market cars, Volkswagen. We saw earlier that any prime will tend to evoke information that is compatible with it. Suggestion and anchoring are both explained by the same automatic operation of System 1. Although I did not know how to prove it at the time, my hunch about the link between anchoring and suggestion turned out to be correct. The Anchoring Index. Many psychological phenomena can be demonstrated experimentally, but few can actually be measured. The effect of anchors is an exception. Anchoring can be measured, and it is an impressively large effect. Some visitors at the San Francisco Exploratorium were asked the following two questions. Is the height of the tallest redwood more or less than 1,200 feet? What is your best guess about the height of the tallest redwood? The high anchor in this experiment was 1,200 feet. For other participants, the first question referred to a low anchor of 180 feet. The difference between the two anchors was 1,020 feet. As expected, the two groups produced very different mean estimates, 844 and 282 feet. The difference between them was 562 feet. The anchoring index is simply the ratio of the two differences, 562 to 1,020, expressed as a percentage, 55%. The anchoring measure would be 100% for people who slavishly adopt the anchor as an estimate, and zero for people who are able to ignore the anchor altogether. The value of 55% that was observed in this example is typical. Similar values have been observed in numerous other problems. The anchoring effect is not a laboratory curiosity. It can be just as strong in the real world. In an experiment conducted some years ago, real estate agents were given an opportunity to assess the value of a house that was actually on the market. They visited the house and studied a comprehensive booklet of information that included an asking price. Half the agents saw an asking price that was substantially higher than the listed price of the house. The other half saw an asking price that was substantially lower. Each agent gave her opinion about a reasonable buying price for the house and the lowest price at which she would agree to sell the house if she owned it. The agents were then asked about the factors that had affected their judgment. Remarkably, the asking price was not one of these factors. The agents took pride in their ability to ignore it. They insisted that the listing price had no effect on their responses, but they were wrong. The anchoring effect was 41%. Indeed, the professionals were almost as susceptible to anchoring effects as business school students with no real estate experience, whose anchoring index was 48%. The only difference between the two groups was that the students conceded that they were influenced by the anchor, while the professionals denied that influence. Powerful anchoring effects are found in decisions that people make about money, such as when they choose how much to contribute to a cause. To demonstrate this effect, we told participants in the exploratorium study about the environmental damage caused by oil tankers in the Pacific Ocean and asked about their willingness to make an annual contribution to save 50,000 offshore Pacific Coast seabirds from small offshore oil spills until ways are found to prevent spills or require tanker owners to pay for the operation. This question requires intensity matching. The respondents are asked, in effect, to find the dollar amount of a contribution that matches the intensity of their feelings about the plight of the seabirds. Some of the visitors were first asked an anchoring question such as, "Would you be willing to pay $5?" before the point-blank question of how much they would contribute. When no anchor was mentioned, the visitors at the exploratorium, generally an environmentally sensitive crowd, said they were willing to pay $64 on average. When the anchoring amount was only $5, contributions averaged $20. When the anchor was a rather extravagant $400, the willingness to pay rose to an average of $143. The difference between the high anchor and low anchor groups was $123. The anchoring effect was above 30%, indicating that increasing the initial request by $100 brought a return of $30 in average willingness to pay. Similar or even larger anchoring effects have been obtained in numerous studies of estimates and of willingness to pay. For example, French residents of the heavily polluted Marseille region were asked what increase in living costs they would accept if they could live in a less polluted region. The anchoring effect was over 50% in that study. Anchoring effects are easily observed in online trading, where the same item is often offered at different buy-now prices. The estimate in fine art auctions is also an anchor that influences the first bid. There are situations in which anchoring appears reasonable. After all, it is not surprising that people who are asked difficult questions clutch at straws, and the anchor is a plausible straw. If you know next to nothing about the trees of California and are asked whether a redwood can be taller than 1,200 feet, you might infer that this number is not too far from the truth. Somebody who knows the true height thought up that question, so the anchor may be a valuable hint. However, a key finding of anchoring research is that anchors that are obviously random can be just as effective as potentially informative anchors. When we used a Wheel of Fortune to anchor estimates of the proportion of African nations in the UN, the anchoring index was 44%, well within the range of effects observed with anchors that could plausibly be taken as hints. Anchoring effects of similar size have been observed in experiments in which the last few digits of the respondent's social security number was used as the anchor. For example, for estimating the number of physicians in their city. The conclusion is clear. Anchors do not have their effects because people believe they are informative. The power of random anchors has been demonstrated in some unsettling ways. German judges with an average of more than 15 years of experience on the bench first read a description of a woman who had been caught shoplifting, then rolled a pair of dice that were loaded so that every roll resulted in either a 3 or a 9. As soon as the dice came to a stop, the judges were asked whether they would sentence the woman to a term in prison greater or lesser in months than the number showing on the dice. Finally, the judges were instructed to specify the exact prison sentence they would give to the shoplifter. On average, those who had rolled a 9 said they would sentence her to 8 months. Those who rolled a 3 said they would sentence her to 5 months. The anchoring effect was 50%. Uses and abuses of anchors. By now you should be convinced that anchoring effects, sometimes due to priming, sometimes to insufficient adjustment, are everywhere. The psychological mechanisms that produce anchoring make us far more suggestible than most of us would want to be. And of course, there are quite a few people who are willing and able to exploit our gullibility. Anchoring effects explain why, for example, arbitrary rationing is an effective marketing ploy. A few years ago, supermarket shoppers in Sioux City, Iowa, encountered a sales promotion for Campbell's soup at about 10% off the regular price. On some days, a sign on the shelf said, limit of 12 per person. On other days, the sign said, no limit per person. Shoppers purchased an average of 7 cans when the limit was in force, twice as many as they bought when the limit was removed. Anchoring is not the sole explanation. Rationing also implies that the goods are flying off the shelves, and shoppers should feel some urgency about stocking up. But we also know that the mention of 12 cans as a possible purchase would produce anchoring even if the number were produced by a roulette wheel. We see the same strategy at work in the negotiation over the price of a home when the seller makes the first move by setting the list price. As in many other games, moving first is an advantage in single-issue negotiations. For example, when price is the only issue to be settled between a buyer and a seller. As you may have experienced when negotiating for the first time in a bazaar, the initial anchor has a powerful effect. My advice to students when I taught negotiations was that if you think the other side has made an outrageous proposal, you should not come back with an equally outrageous counteroffer, creating a gap that will be difficult to bridge in further negotiations. Instead, you should make a scene, storm out or threaten to do so, and make it clear to yourself, as well as to the other side, that you will not continue the negotiation with that number on the table. The psychologists Adam Galinsky and Thomas Musweiler proposed more subtle ways to resist the anchoring effect in negotiations. They instructed negotiators to focus their attention and search their memory for arguments against the anchor. The instruction to activate System 2 was successful. For example, the anchoring effect is reduced or eliminated when the second mover focuses his attention on the minimal offer that the opponent would accept, or on the costs to the opponent of failing to reach an agreement. In general, a strategy of deliberately thinking the opposite may be a good defense against anchoring effects, because it negates the biased recruitment of thoughts that produces these effects. Finally, try your hand at working out the effect of anchoring on a problem of public policy, the size of damages in personal injury cases. These awards are sometimes very large. Businesses that are frequent targets of such lawsuits, such as hospitals and chemical companies, have lobbied to set a cap on the awards. Before you read this chapter, you might have thought that capping awards is certainly good for potential defendants, but now you should not be so sure. Consider the effect of capping awards at $1 million. This rule would eliminate all larger awards. but the anchor would also pull up the size of many awards that would otherwise be much smaller. It would almost certainly benefit serious offenders and large firms.